We're doing Parashat Nitzavim, one of the shortest parashiyot in the Torah. After that great rebuke and warning and curses we read about in last week's parasha, the people were devastated. And Moshe brings them in to discuss the final covenant he will perform with them. Our sages say that from this parasha onward, the rest of the Torah took place on the final day of Moshe's life. That from Parshat Nitzavim till the end of the Torah, all took place on the 7th of Adar. So Moshe calls everyone together for a covenant. Now, the first thing he tells them is, you're here. You've made it. And so you've had to deal with punishment and doing things wrong, but you've made it, and you'll continue making it. And that's a very important point of encouragement. Sometimes in life we look forward and we're not sure how we're going to overcome the obstacles that await us. No, thank you. We don't have answers. 5 years ago, either 4 or 5 years ago, I think it was 5 years ago, I had to give a speech on the night of Rosh Hashanah. And at that point, Mubarak was in jail, and the Muslim Brotherhood had come to power. They had sworn that they wouldn't sell us any more gas, and that they were out to destroy us, and that they didn't feel obligated to the peace treaty with Egypt. In the north, Syria was threatening, and we were told that the Hezbollah had amassed so much weapons that everything from the past was irrelevant. They were crossing over the border. The UN was ignoring them. We had heard by then that the UN had even helped them kidnap an Israeli soldier. They knew full well what was going on and they had turned a blind eye. On the Jordanian front, they were making problems. And we had the Iranian threat. Hamas had come to power. And now you had a situation where on every front, it looked like we were on the brink of war. Barack Obama made it abundantly clear he wasn't our friend. And we're entering Rosh Hashanah. Okay? No one was calm going into that Rosh Hashanah. Everyone was uptight.
What was this?
This was either 4 or 5 years ago. Right now we're 2:15. It was either 2:10 or 2:11. Okay? So when I had to give that speech, I said to the people, you know, last time the Muslim Brotherhood came to power was under who?
Nasser.
And what was the first thing he did? Murder every member of the Muslim Brotherhood but himself. Killed everyone and outlawed it. So just because the Muslim Brotherhood came to power doesn't mean it's going to be bad for us. And ultimately signed a peace treaty with us. No one knows where the world's heading. Up in the north, yeah, there's the Hezbollah, but you don't know what God's plan is with the Hezbollah. Down in the south, we don't know. We're standing before an unknown. We have what to be worried about, but we don't know. And all these unknowns can get together to formulate a beautiful picture for Am Yisrael. We don't have to paint it. We have to do our hishtadlut. But right now our hishtadlut is we're going to accept Rosh Hashanah with full focus on our task this Rosh Hashanah. And we're going to realize that now Hashem is going to decide that. He's king. And now he's going to decide the way the year is going to play itself out. And now we're standing 4 or 5 years later, and Muslim Brotherhood's gone, outlawed, they're all in jail, some alive, some dead, right? We have one of the best relationships we ever had with Egypt in the history of the State of Israel. The military cooperation that's going on, you know, they're flooding as many tunnels as they can find on that front. They hate the Muslim Brotherhood more than we do. They hate the Hamas more than we do. They're ready to come in here and wipe them all out in 2 days, if we'd only let them. On the northern front, the Hezbollah is being wiped out by ISIS. So people were worried ISIS is going to be a threat. So 2 days ago, Russia sent in troops and now they're fighting ISIS for us. Think about it. You know how many weapons we would have needed to fight the Hezbollah? You know what? They had so many underground tunnels and so many video cameras that when we fought the last war, soldiers were being shot by joysticks, by buttons. They sat in their caves. Our soldiers were advancing. They had video cameras attached to weapons. They would see our soldiers and shoot without endangering themselves. We were on their territory. They were so well established in the north, so prepared for war with us, that we knew that in order to go to war against them, we'd have to suffer tremendous casualties. And look what the Ribbono Shel Olam did. Look at what's been happening. ISIS has been fighting them a fight that we wouldn't have been able to do. We couldn't have focused so many forces on the north. We have to worry about our other borders. So things got taken care of. Who could have envisioned that this is where the world was headed? You know, 3 years ago, what's the name, the head of Syria? Assad was saying he's going to take back the Golan. Assad was saying, I'll make a peace treaty with you after you give me the Golan. Where's Assad now? He's got a fifth of his country, right? He's got nothing left. He's got almost no army. So you look at the map 5 years ago, and it was a very threatening map. The Shabak was saying, we don't know. I heard this from someone inside behind closed doors meetings. He said to me, the conversations were, how long is it logical for the state to last? But no one thought the state of Israel could last too long. The discussion between security experts was, is there logic that we could last 10 years, 12 years, 15 years? No one thought we could last too long because the threats were overwhelming and they didn't have solutions for them. We didn't have solutions, but we're not the ones that run the show. And the message of Atem Nitzavim Hayom Kulchem is, you made it this far and you can't take the credit for having made it this far. You've done this much, the Ribbono Shel Olam has done a million times more. So that idea, I've made it this far, I'm going to be able to deal further. That's an idea of encouragement Moshe told the Jewish people, we have to tell ourselves. Very often life's challenges put us in a situation where we don't have the solution. I don't know what I'm going to do now. I don't know. But I've made it this far. There's a saying they say in Israeli society, and as a joke they say it, but there's truth to it. We dealt with Paro, we'll deal with him. You know, we have a history. Atem nitzavim hayom kulchem. Moshe tells him, you've made it this far. Your heads of state, your elders, your policemen, you're all here. And now, we're going to make a covenant. So you're going to make a covenant. And the covenant is, you're going to be his people, and future generations, everyone is going to be faithful to the Torah. And Hashem warns them, you know, maybe someone's thinking in his heart, I'm going to do my thing, and the rest of the people of Israel are going to do their thing. And that's a very tempting thing to do. It's very tempting in life to go along with the flow, but then in my own house, I'm going to do what I want. Very tempting. I can sit there, I could be there. Who's going to know the difference? Do I pay taxes? Don't I pay taxes? Why do I have to pay taxes? You don't benefit from the taxes you pay. You don't benefit? Who deals with the street? I had a group of people bounce upon me and tell me it's wrong to pay taxes. I said, why? They said, look at all the bad things the state does. I said, if a robber is breaking into your house, who do you call? You're at home, you hear a robber breaking in. I've been there. We were once home one night, and we heard in the back that someone was breaking into the house. So what do? You call the police. But why are you calling the police? You don't pay them. You're not willing to pay them taxes. You don't pay them, but when you need them, you do call them. So we live. But it's very convenient not to do that. There was a shul, two shuls in the city. One shul was the wealthy man's shul. And all the wealthy people davened there. Membership cost a fortune. But on Simchat Torah, when they would dance, so they would bring these big kegs filled with vodka, and everyone could just fill their cup as they were dancing. You know, limitless. As many cups of vodka as you want, you could have. On the other side of town was the poor man's shul. I heard the story from Rabbi Beryl Wine. And the poor man's shul, they had a Simchas Torah, but no one could afford to supply kegs of vodka. So one year they convened the council of the poor man's shul, and they said, we should have a Simchas Torah next year just like them. How can we have a Simchas Torah next year? Well, every week, every one of us can afford one cup of vodka. So what we're going to do is we're going to set up kegs. And every week, Friday night, everyone that comes to shul will bring one little cup, a vodka cup of vodka. And if every member supplies one cup of vodka every Shabbos, then when we hit Simchas Torah next year, we'll have a few kegs, and then we'll all be able to enjoy it on Simchas Torah. That's what they said. That's what they agreed. Everyone said, great idea. And that's what happened. Starting that Friday, every member of shul religiously came. They walked into shul, they'd lift the top of the keg, put in their little cup of vodka, close the keg. Okay? So this is going on for 51 weeks. And Simchas Torah is approaching, and you could sense excitement in the air. Everyone's excited. This year we're going to be like them. We're going to have vodka without limits. And comes the dancing of Simchas Torah. They open up the keg, and you know what? Everyone fills their cup. They all say, L'chaim, make a shachal ni'abitvar, and they drink, and they discover it's all water. Why? Everyone thought, if everyone else is bringing vodka, I could bring just water. And everyone thought the same thing. Everyone had the same brilliant idea. No one's going to know if I put in only water, right? So suddenly, there's only water. It's like the town that had exactly 10 people for a minyan. And so everyone showed up every morning on time for minyan, right? Because they knew without them, there was no minyan. And then one day a person had a guest over, so no one showed up the next morning. Everyone figured, they're managing without me. Today I could take a day off, right? Everyone did the same cheshbon. But you know what? That's part of our nature. If everyone's doing it, why do I have to do it? Everyone's going to clean up. I could slip away. Comes the Torah and says, no, it doesn't work that way. Everyone has a responsibility. Everyone has to take a personal responsibility. Hashem says, and I look at you individually. There's an aspect where we stand in shul on Rosh Hashanah and we're a part of the crowd. That's a great thing to be a part of the crowd. Hashem says, I look at everyone's merits and you all cover for one another. You come to me as a team and I look positively upon you. But then you come to Ribbono Shel Olam and you're an individual. At the end of the day, we say, Kivakarat ro'e edro. Just like when a shepherd looks at each sheep as he takes them out of the corral, he checks how each one's doing, he checks which one's dehydrated, which one's limping, he sees each one. That's what happens on Rosh Hashanah night. Everyone goes up there. And everyone gets their own time with their Ribbono Shel Olam, every soul. And so Hashem says, I look at each of you, and if a person thinks that now that you've entered Israel, I go to my own home, I do my own private thing, I'm not responsible, no. Hashem says, you are mutually responsible, and I will take a person to task. I'll take all of you to task if you turned a blind eye. And you said, live and let live, let him do what he wants, what do I care? So he put up a Zeus in his house. So Friday night, when they make Kiddush, they pour a cup to Zeus also. So what do I care? Is my business? Yeah, it's your business. Part of being a unified people is that I care what happens by my neighbor. I know of a community where no one desecrated Shabbos. They didn't. And then someone's son decided that he's not keeping Shabbos anymore. And then the kid decided that he's riding home on his motorcycle on Shabbos. And the community went silent. No one said anything. So you know what happened? Within a short time, you had a lot of kids riding motorcycles on Shabbos. So you'll say, what's my problem? It is your problem. It's not only your problem because it affects everyone else. It's your problem because you should care for him. Talk to him. There was a person here in Jerusalem whose son was working with the early Israeli Defense Force under the Britons. So, you know, there was the Etzel, the Agana, the Lehi, three different approaches how to deal with the British. And he was working with the Lehi, and his father lived in Mea Shearim. And his father comes to Rav Arya Levine one day. You guys heard of Rav Arya Levine? Rav Arya Levine was a very pious Jew who lived in Mea Shearim, not far from here. And he was known as the one who loved every Jew. When there were people from the forces who were put in jail to be hung by the British, he would go to jail every day and talk to them and encourage them, bring them letters from their wives. The British respected him as a great rabbi. And he was also very loved because he didn't look at whether a person was observant or not observant. He loved every Jew. So he taught many things. So one of the things that happened was this father comes to him from Mea Shearim and he says, my son is driving on Shabbos and people are going to stone his car and he's working with the Lehi, but what am I supposed to do? So Rav Arya Levine tells him, do me a favor. Tell your son I want to meet with him. I let him come here Friday afternoon. Tell him I want to meet with him. The father says, you sure? He says, yes. Tell him I want to meet with him. Okay, the father comes home. He tells the kid, the old rabbi, I can't make him come here. He wants to talk to you. Do me a favor. Let's go over to the rabbi's house. So the kid argues this way. The kid argues that way. Finally, he agrees. They come to Rav Arya Levine's house. And the Rebbetzin says, I'm sorry, he's out at the mikveh, he'll be back in a minute, he just went to get ready for Shabbos. Rav Arya Levine comes in, and he's still wet from the mikveh. He runs over to the young man, and he says, thank you so much for coming here. I know it must have been so hard, but you know, I'm an old man, it's hard for me to get out. I appreciate it greatly. Come on in, let me give you a drink. He sits down, the young man, he sits with him, and he says to him, it's such an honor that you came all the way here. I wanted to discuss with her, you, I heard that you are involved in tremendous mitzvot, and I heard that you're saving people's lives, and I hear that what you're doing is so important that halachically you're allowed to drive on Shabbos, because to save a human life, you're allowed to drive on Shabbos. And I wanted to thank you for what you're doing. It's beautiful, it's amazing work what you're doing. Now, not everyone knows when you get into that car on Shabbos that you're going to save a life. So I wanted to ask you, in order so that people don't get upset with you, they won't know. And what you're doing is so important. Do me a favor. I don't live far from you. The next time you have to go driving on Shabbos, send your father to call me. I want to sit in the passenger seat. People will see me sitting next to you, no one will throw a rock at you. Everyone will know that you're doing a mitzvah. So do me a favor. You're doing important work. You're saving the people of Israel. You're the future of the people of Israel. I want to ensure that people appreciate the great work you're doing. Keep up the good work. The guy never drove on Shabbos again. You understand? He wasn't only driving to save lives. Once he started driving to save lives, he was driving on Shabbos. And when Rav Aryeh Levin approached him warmly, positively, told him how much he values him, appreciates him, so the guy stopped driving on Shabbos. We're supposed to care. Care doesn't mean I pick up a rock and say, the guy's driving on Shabbos, let me throw a rock at his car. First of all, the rock's muktzah. Secondly, if you care about him, talk to him. Befriend him. Show him you appreciate him. Touch his soul in a positive way. The Chazon Ish writes that if we were to control the state, we being the observant people, we would not enforce laws that would force people to observe mitzvot. Even though our parsha says you have to care whether your neighbor keeps mitzvot or not, the Chazon Ish writes that wouldn't be conducive. You're going to force people, keep Shabbos, that's it. We're walking around, the police force is going to check every neighborhood. You better not turn on a light on Shabbos. We catch you, you're fine, 5,000 shekel. It's not going to work. That's not how you educate people. So the Torah tells us there's a mutual responsibility. That mutual responsibility has to be expressed in a positive way. And if you can't express it positively, which is the nature of most people, so then you can't do it. You're not allowed to come to a person out of hatred or anger and tell them, hey, you shouldn't be doing this. No, you have no right. If you know the person, you know how to approach them, you know how to touch them, how to befriend them, then you could try and help them. But if you're not loving the person when you talk to them, then you can't talk to them. The idea of mutual responsibility gives us another beautiful halacha. The halacha of arevut, we are co-signers, we're mutually responsible, entitles us to help other people perform mitzvot. So let's say you blow shofar. You did your mitzvah, you blew shofar. Now you hear there's someone down the hall who didn't hear shofar yet. You can go and blow shofar for them. Why can you do it? You did your mitzvah already. You made kiddush Friday night. How could you make kiddush for the next person? We spent quite a few Friday nights in the hospital, and I would go around to I would wait for the midwives to make kiddush for them, because there are midwives who won't eat till they hear kiddush Friday night, and they don't feel comfortable making kiddush for themselves. So there are midwives who fast for hours Friday night until they get home and their husband makes kiddush for them. So when I was in the hospital Friday night, I'd wait and make kiddush for the midwives. How can I make kiddush for them? And if I make kiddush for my wife, can I make kiddush for them? So that's the idea of arevim. We're mutually responsible. And I didn't finish my mitzvah till every Jew in the world got their mitzvah done. And that's why we can make blessings for one another, even though we already made ours. Hashem says, I warned you with blessings and curses. And the key here is that wherever you are, if things go wrong, think about it and say, I have to do tshuva. That's a key concept within the rebukes of the parasha. A person has to think, what's Hashem telling me? And Hashem says, you will do tshuva, I'll bring you back to the land of Israel. I'll gather you again. And it doesn't matter how far away you are, I'll bring you back to the land of Israel. And I will help you, I will bless you, where it will be easier for you to keep Torah and mitzvot. What does Hashem say? Umal Hashem Elokecha et levavcha ve'et levav zarecha. Hashem will circumcise your heart and the heart of your kids. What does that mean to circumcise the heart? Our nature, our heart drives us to all kinds of things. You see things that are immodest, our sages say your heart right away wants it. So our heart can be circumcised. Our heart can be affected that we will want the right things, that we'll have clarity in our desires. But the Torah says more than that. The Torah says you and your kids. And here there's a beautiful vort, a nice Dvar Torah, with a very important message for all of us. The nature of the world is that we tend to rebel. And we rebel against what we saw when we were growing up. So very often when a person does the teshuva process, their children rebel. It is very common that after a person has done teshuvah, they start observing Torah and mitzvot, that their children look at that and say, not for me. And a chozer b'tshuvah has greater hardship in bringing up their children to keep Torah and mitzvot. There are numerous reasons for that. One of the reasons is overexposure, overexposing the kids to non-observance. Very often a person is observing Torah and mitzvot, but their parents are visiting, and their parents are not. So in the child's mind, there are two options. Dad chose a different route than the grandparents, so I can choose a different route than Dad. Because if the child grows up and he's overly exposed to the other options, to his uncle, to his grandparents, so then in his mind there are two options. That's food for thought. That's a very scary thought. And that's why sometimes we ask parents, even if they're not Jewish, we say, when you're visiting the kids, put on a yarmulke. When you're visiting in our house, keep Shabbos. You want to turn on a TV? You want to do other things? Okay, you could do that in your own house. You're coming to me for Shabbos. Help me. It's going to confuse the kids. It's not that we're close-minded. It's that if you're going to confuse the kid and make him think like there are all kinds of options out there, there's a difference between a child who walks on the street and sees a stranger desecrating Shabbos and a child who's at home who sees his grandparent desecrating Shabbos. It's different. So that's one reason. There are more. Yes.
Have the option either way. So whether or not, I used to go on the point that you say close around, we're doing it, like the options are going to be there no matter what.
So the option's always there. You and I have the option right now too. But there's a difference between feeling like these are two normalcies or having a base point of a normalcy and then later on discovering that there are two options. If from the onset a child feels like I have two options, you don't give them normalcy. That's the big mistake that they're making with rainbow education. When you teach a child that Bob can have two dads, you're telling him it's normal to have a mom and a dad. It's normal to have two dads. It's normal to have two moms. You choose. You're distorting the child's perception. Start out with normalcy. Let the child have a baseline. I know what's normal. Later on in life, I'll discover that there are people who do all kinds of things. But I'm not going to tell a child, you should know, some people eat on a plate and some people eat on the floor. We'll have one meal on the plate, and then when your grandparents come, we'll eat off the floor. No, what's wrong? You don't say that. You say, I want you to know what's normal. This is what's right. Okay.
But not just from the, if you have family that, even from the onset, even if you don't directly see them doing these actions, say the example of your close family, you're going to know from the onset what they are.
Why? Why do you have to know that?
Like,
I had relatives who watched TV on Shabbos. I didn't know that until once I walked in on them watching TV on Shabbos. You know.
So they visit you, they're supposed to pretend that, like...
Why not? Why can't they be respectful? They're there for a certain number of hours. Let's say they're coming by car for Shabbos lunch. They don't have to park in front of the house.
Right.
They can park up the block. Why does the child have to see it? I had a friend of mine whose father used to show up in the middle of Shabbos on his motorcycle. Why? Park at the corner. The kids don't have to see it. When the kids see it, you're telling them, I'm giving you two choices. Why should I give them that choice at this point? Let me first teach you what my path in life. Later on in life, everyone has choices. But you want to give them a baseline. One of the greatest gifts you could give them is a perspective. This is what we do. Later on, okay, they'll definitely be exposed. The more you can push that off, the more you're giving them a baseline. You should know that children like clarity. It's only as we grow and we reach the teenage years and the later teenage years that we start appreciating that there are shades of gray. But just like a child wants every story to end with they lived happily ever after, a child wants to know, this is right, this is wrong, this is good, this is bad. Give me clarity. A child takes to, our nature is that we like to have an understanding what's right and what's wrong. But if you tell a child, this is right for me and this is right for grandpa, okay, so you're not giving him a baseline. We would go to shul and people would give the kids candy. And we don't eat every heksher. So the kids would come over and say, Abba, is this kosher? And I'd say, if someone gave it to you, if a Jewish person gave it to you, then we can assume it's kosher. The question is, do we eat that heksher? The question isn't, is it kosher? Respect the other person. He didn't give you something non-kosher. But then there's another question, do we eat that heksher or not? So kids can understand. Okay, we take on a level of stringency. We don't necessarily eat every heksher other people eat. Fine, I can understand that. But tell a child, Grandpa eats non-kosher. Grandpa could eat pork, but we don't. What are you going to tell him? Grandpa's wrong. How much do you want to tell him that? And even if you do tell him that, that's going to succeed anything? He loves Grandpa. Grandpa gives him gifts. He's a good guy. What does the kid know? I'm saying, so we try to give them a baseline. We try to develop an understanding. This is right, this is wrong. But one challenge that a Chozer B'Tshuva has is that as much as you try, very often you have that challenge that the children are exposed. And again, if you think about it, you could limit that. The second challenge Chozer B'Tshuva has is that everyone's a work in progress, but a Chozer B'Tshuva is a greater work in progress. When a person is Chozer B'Tshuva, he's got the fire that he's willing to keep growing. You come to shul, how often do you see people making big changes? You look at a Chozer B'Tshuva, you could see him growing his whole life. You could see tremendous change because a Chozer B'Tshuva has stamina and power that no one else does. You know, we had a complaint one year where someone said the davening was too long. So I mentioned that to one of the people in charge of the shul who happens to be a Chozer B'Tshuva. And he looks at me and he says, that was not a Chozer B'Tshuva who said that. I said, what do you mean? He says, no, Chozer B'Tshuva comes with complaints like that. Chozer B'Tshuva has strength. He was talking about himself too. He said, if we've done the whole path, no one gets too tired, the davening's too long, or no, that's not the complaint that you'll get from someone who's done the process. When you really do the process, you want to continue growing. But that growth can very often be sporadic with ups and downs and changes, and that confuses kids. If a person, I had a friend, he used to tell us. One year my dad says, no TV, it's the worst thing in the world. A year later, the TV's back in the house and we're watching all the filthiest movies. A year later comes Rosh Hashanah, my father says, no, it's a terrible thing what we did, we've got to get TV out of the house, terrible thing, kick TV out of the house. Another year or two without TV, back and forth. Kids need balance. And even if that balance you feel is a level of mediocrity, be careful with your growth. Slow and steady, but slow. And the third point is that Chozrim B'Tshuva have a strength, that Chozrim B'Tshuva are willing to go against the whole world. Most of your friends did not do the tshuva process and you don't care. And that's a strength. You say, I'm right and I'm going to do it. But that strength is a double-edged sword because sometimes a person says, I don't care if no one else does this. If my Shmona Esrei takes me 2 hours, I'm going to stay in shul 2 hours and I don't care if the whole world isn't taking 2 hours. That's a strength. But when a child grows up with that, very often a child doesn't feel, he doesn't know what his place is. I'm not like everyone else. And that's where a Chozer B'Tshuva has to give things a little bit of thought. You're entitled to be unique, but you don't want your child to feel like he doesn't fit in. Part of connecting to Judaism is to feel like I'm a part of what's going on here. And if a person says, I had a friend who he wanted to broaden his children's horizons. So one Shabbos meal they do on the floor sitting like the Chinese. The next Shabbos meal they would do, they'd have tablecloths from Japan, and they'd eat with chopsticks. The next week they wanted to teach him Dutch culture. You know, so it's a very nice idea, but when you take the Shabbos table, and no one else does a Shabbos table like this, every few weeks there's something else weird going on, so then the child doesn't feel like he's like anyone else. He goes to his friend's house, they sing Miros, and he says, I could teach you Japanese Miros, I could teach you Japanese tunes. Okay, but he doesn't feel like he fits in. So we discussed three challenges. Who remembers what they were? Number one is the grandparents, the extended family, the feeling that there's broader normalcy which erodes the values you're trying to teach. Number two was ups and downs, when a person can't maintain consistency. And number three was?
To fit in.
Just because something's a good idea, we have to tone down that nature that a Chozer B'Tshuva has, where he says, I don't care what anyone thinks, I'm doing what's right. Yeah, let's care a little bit to fit in. As much as you'll care, it won't be enough, I guarantee it. It's still something to think about. Comes the Torah and tells us, and when you reach that generation that Hashem will help you, He will circumcise your heart and your son's heart. Why? Because we just said, the nature of man is that even if you do tshuva, the children say, I'll rebel the other way. Hashem promises you, I'll help you and your kids. It'll continue. That's the Dvar Torah people say, the four sons represent four generations. The Chacham, he's the wise son, he keeps the Torah. His next son, he rebels, he goes the other way. That's the Rasha. The next son, he sees the grandpa's a tzaddik, the father's a Rasha, he's a tum, he's like confused, he doesn't know too much. And then the Sheino Yidali Shol, the fourth generation, he doesn't even know what to ask. He never saw the grandfather. He didn't see the grandfather who's a Chacham. He only saw the grandfather who's a Roshan, his father who doesn't know anything. He's Sheino Yidali Shol, he doesn't even know what questions to ask. Then you have the Tshuva process, you start with the Chacham, and the process goes all over again. So there is something to that. The Torah says, I'll help you. At that time, I'll help you and your son, I'll help you have continuum. The mitzvot I'm giving you now, says Moshe Rabbeinu, they are not covered. They are accessible. That's an important point. Anyone who wants to access Torah can. All you have to do is work. Okay? It's not so far away. It's not in the heavens. You don't have to climb to the heavens to get the Torah. It's not across the sea. It's right there. It's your nature. It's within your capacity to do it. And that's one of the phenomenal things that Geirim will attest to. I was born into an observant home, I had it easy. But Geirim will very often say, until I came to the Torah, I didn't find anything that was natural to me. I learned the Torah and suddenly I found, hey, this fits, it just feels right, this is natural. The Torah says you should know, it's near your nature. It's so in line, in sync with what's right for you. The Torah says, Beficha uvilvavcha lasot. It's within your lips and your heart to perform. Within your lips and your heart to perform. Beficha uvilvavcha. And our sages say, this is the oral Torah that we give over with our lips. It's not written. Okay, today we wrote it. Torah says it's not in the heavens, it's not over the sea. From here our sages derived, if you want to succeed in Torah, you can't be a merchant. You can't spend your whole life looking to become a millionaire and think you're going to succeed in Torah. You can't do both together. You can, if you want to do Torah, you gotta dedicate yourself to Torah. From here, our sages derive, the written Torah may not be said by heart. Right? If you're reading from the Torah scroll, in order to read from the Torah on Shabbos, right? You're not allowed to read the verses by heart. Written Torah must be read from a text when you're saying it in order to say it on behalf of other people. Oral Torah must be kept oral. Then the rabbis saw under the persecution of the Romans, they were losing the tradition. So they said, we have to transgress this commandment and write down the oral Torah, otherwise we'll lose it all. Hashem says, I've given you a choice of life and good or death and evil. And I'm choosing you, and I'm commanding you, choose life, go in the way of Hashem. This pasuk tells us we have free will. Ordinarily a person would think, if Hashem knows the future, why would I think I have free will? Comes the Torah and says, I'm giving you a choice. It's part of your godliness. Make the right choice. Why does the Torah have to tell us to make the right choice? Because we have this tendency to like drag racing, to enjoy driving without a seatbelt on. There's a thrill to playing with death. And the Torah says, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. I went to the bathroom once in yeshiva. This story goes back about 15, 20 years ago. And it was a month or two after Rosh Hashanah. And I see a revolver sitting there. And I take the revolver in my hand and I think to myself, it's a little bit early for Purim. And this revolver weighs a little bit much. And my finger's on the trigger. And I'm holding it just about this way, right near my head. And I'm thinking to myself, is it okay if I found a kid's gun to pull one shot? I haven't heard a cap gun go off in so many years. I'll find the kid, I'll pay him for the cap. And then I said to myself, but this weighs a little bit much for a cap gun. And I'm telling you, I was a split second from pulling the trigger. It was a real revolver. Okay, it was a real revolver, and I didn't know it. Some guy had gone to the bathroom, and the revolver fell out of his pants. And I'm holding this revolver there next to my head, and it didn't dawn on me that such a little gun could be a real gun. It was during the time of the Second Intifada, and he had to drive to yeshiva, and he was being shot at as he was driving. He went with his revolver loaded. I mean, had I pulled that trigger, I don't know if I'd be here today. Well, the Torah says choose life. Don't play games with death. You know, people like to own guns. Yeah, how many people's lives were saved by owning guns? And how many people's lives were lost by owning guns? Especially Americans who come to Israel, they think it's very cool to own a gun. Think about it. Will you ever forget it? Will it ever drop out of your hand? Well, people have to think. Uvachata b'chaim, the Torah says, choose life. Choose life and you and your children will live. Love Hashem and keep the mitzvot, and that is your longevity in the land of Israel. Hashem tells us this is the key to us succeeding over here. And that is the conclusion of our parasha. We went through a quick version of the